This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Hotwire. This is our first episode for 2026 and I'm glad to have you with us. Because the year has started with a reminder of how quickly things can change in rural New Zealand. Parts of the country are currently dealing with flooding in the aftermath, and for many farming families, that is not just an inconvenience, it is damage, disruption, stress, and a heavy recovery job that often lands right on top of everything else. To everyone affected, we are thinking of you, and I hope you have the support around you to get through it. Now, today's episode takes us across the Tasman for an Australian story that feels surprisingly familiar because it is about resilience, diversification, and the determination to make farming work in a changing world. We have a guest host this week, Liv Thorne, and she sat down with third-generation farmer Mitchell from the Manjimup and Pemberton region in Western Australia. A remarkable little pocket of productivity that supplies a huge share of Australia's summer avocados and produces a huge range of fruit, vegetables, and livestock. Mitchell's story is about leaving the farm, coming back, and doing something different, building Wallara Gold alongside his partner Jennifer, and turning passion fruit waste into products, markets, and an entirely new business model that now supports other growers as well. Let's get into it, and Liv picks up from here.
I'm a third generation farmer, farming on my family's farm right now with my parents. My sister's still there, and my partner Jennifer. I run and operate Wallara Gold with Jen, so that's separate to the family farm, but still on the same site. My background, I guess, was, you know, being a traditional farm kid, growing up on the farm, always having to work weekends and holidays, that sort of thing. So I got a real taste of what true farming family lifestyle is like. Did everything I possibly could to get out of it. Found myself leaving at the first opportunity to head straight to the city and spent about 4 or 5 years working there and studying. And eventually came full circle and realised that maybe the farming life and country life isn't so bad, and came back to the family farm and decided I'm going to change the world, and here I am now.
Now, for those listening who aren't familiar with Manjimup, yeah, how would you describe this food hub that we find ourselves in the southwest patch of WA?
Manji is such a unique place, one for its diversity of products. It produces about a range of 80 different fruits and vegetables as well as livestock, but as its diversity in industry and culture as well. We've seen a lot of our industries, we've had timber, tobacco, avocados, apples, just to name a few, come through very big and very strong in our region. And a lot of those have sort of either collapsed or been taken away from us by government policy or just via international markets and those sorts of things, not being there anymore. So because of that, the people who remain in Manjimup we find are extremely resilient. They're always looking for opportunities, hence why there's such diversity in our region. And I think it's a really good narrative and really good story just to show that people who are there for a reason, and they're there to run their businesses and to accomplish something. And again, they're there because of that resilience. So that's why I think Manji is such a unique little hotspot, or a little melting pot, I guess you would say, of different products and people.
I heard that Manjimup, or the Manjimup Pemberton area, produces something like a third of the country's avocados, for example.
Yeah, so in summer, for instance, it's 80% of Australia's supply.
Wow.
Comes from just the Manjimup Pemberton, yeah, region. So, you know, for a small region, it sort of, yeah, punches the well above its weight, I should say.
From cauliflowers, marron, citrus, pome fruit, it's got
passion
it all.
Fruit.
Oh, and passion fruit. And that brings me to the point of difference. So you've come back after studying, back to the family farming business with your eyes wide open. Yeah. What was your point of difference? How did you shake things up?
I guess just going out a bit more and seeing a bit more of the world. Realising, one, that, you know, farming is such a noble profession and I think should be taken a lot more seriously, especially with young people. But getting a bit of difference and experience in the world also means that you don't have to do things the way they've always been done. We can sort of fall into traps of, you know, sticking to what our parents have always done or the previous generations have done, hoping that we'll get the same outcomes. But as we know, the world changes, people move on. So we do need to adapt and learn to change. And I think the best way to do that, to become a good farmer, is actually just to leave. Just leave for a little while, get some experience, learn from other people, have a bit of fun. But it does make for a better farmer and for a better person as well. So I'm not saying that, you know, I'm the best farmer out there or anything like that, but, you know, just having those little tidbits just helps along the way. So when it comes to making decisions or finding a network, you sort of go with an open mind and a bit more with your eyes open, I guess you would say.
So why passion fruit?
I guess passion fruit are my second favourite fruit. My first is mango, and we can't grow mango in Manjimup. So if you're going to grow something, you may as well grow something you like. In saying that, though, when I did do it start, knew nothing about how passion fruit grew. I thought it was something that grew on your nana's back fence and you just picked it in summer. And I thought that was how easy it was going to be. Boy, was I wrong. It was and still is such a steep learning curve, not just passion fruit, but any product trying to grow it, and but to grow it well and to understand its needs and how you fit in the market as well. So that's, I guess, why I started growing it. It still is my second favourite fruit, I guess you would say. You know, at times it's my most hated crop, but I do love it, yeah.
So you sell fresh passion fruit into the normal market.
Yep.
But what I want to learn from you, Mitchell, is the drivers behind you value adding your passion fruit product. What drove you to add that value to the traditional supply chain?
So passion fruit are, like, I guess you would say, a fairly high waste product. So out of most fruits, passion fruit is one of the highest producing ethylene fruit. So it means the gas that starts to produce once it's come off the vine, to basically break it down. So things that will start to happen, it'll start to wrinkle up very quickly. If it's not kept in the right conditions, you'll get mold development on the fruit. So you've got a very, very short window to sell that fruit. On the other hand as well, the fruit is not like an apple or a cherry where you can pick it in a two-week window. Sometimes you're picking up to 6 months. So that creates these challenges. You've got a very short window to pick it. You've also got a very long season. So we have these peaks in production where we have a lot of fruit and we can't cool store it. And then we have these real troughs. So you start to try and go and develop a market. But then 2 weeks later, you haven't got enough fruit to fill that market because suddenly your fruit's dried up. So what do? You've got to find these little niche pockets outside of the traditional commodity market where we tend to sell most of our fruit and vegetables and go, all right, the fruit that's on the tail end that's either overripe or it's getting a little bit of disease or I can't sell it quick enough, what do I do with that? And for us, that was ended up being about 30% of our crop. Now, anyone in farming will know if you're getting, you know, higher than, say, 5 or even 8% wastage or unsaleable, we like to say, it's not worth doing it because it's just such a big portion of your crop that you're not getting a return for. You've still invested all that time, invested all that energy, fertilizer. You're still harvesting it. You're treating it the same way, but you're not getting it. So if you think of it like your job, you know, you're doing 30% extra work, you're not getting paid for it. So we just thought, well, this is madness. There's an opportunity, a 30% opportunity there for us to turn something that's generating zero economic return to us to something that will generate some sort of economic return for us. That was essentially our goal, was to be able to utilize 100% of our crop. And through the means of processing and value adding, we've been able to do that. And because of we've been able to do that, we've then been able to approach other farmers who are in the same situation and say, we know that you've got a wastage issue. We've got a market for that. How about we buy it off you, give you a financial return, let us deal with it. And then we started to create these relationships and this community around how we utilize waste together. And it's opened up a whole lot of doors by doing that. And we never would have had these opportunities if we didn't just bite the bullet and invest the money.
So you saw an opportunity there. What products are you creating out of this wasted passion fruit?
When we first started, our goal was to pulp it, put it in a jar and sell it as an ingredient for things like putting on pavlovas, smoothies, ice creams. What we found, people really only bought it around Christmas. That's when they want to use it. And then after that, there wasn't a lot of repeat customers. So again, we created a product and we didn't know what the market wanted. Then we thought, what else can we do with it? We went to breweries, we went to restaurants, we started selling bulk. And that was really good because it got rid of a lot of the product very quickly. But again, it was for a lower return financially. But that inspired us. We got to see what others were doing with it. And we thought, well, why aren't we doing that? And we started to figure out ways of doing that. So our first product other than the pulp was a cordial. It's a family recipe from Jen's mum. She gave us some bottles she made and we kept trying. And well, this is really good. And my dad kept coming back and he's to the house and saying, can I get a bit more of that cordial?
It doesn't match the Nana's vine on the back fence.
Pretty much,
that's yeah. That's where it came from.
Basically, yeah. You know, it's a family recipe and the whole thing is a whole family connection. And because we knew that it tasted good, we liked it, and other people might like it. So that's what we did. We got the recipe, we figured out how to do it, and literally just went to markets and tested it, got feedback. And the more we made, the more we sold. So we thought, well, there's clearly something here. We've got to keep trialing this. So we started with other fruits. We did cherry, we did berries, we did a whole range of different things. And the feedback we kept getting was, we love your product, but we don't want to have to keep adding water or sparkling water to it. Can you make it a ready-to-drink drink? We sort of thought, oh, that's a bit more of a big step because it's a whole huge amount of investment. It's a lot of technical understanding on how to make beverages, especially carbonated, unfermented beverages. Till eventually we thought, well, people are telling us what they want. We have to actually listen to what they want. So we just figured out a way how to do it. It meant having to partner with a local brewery to come up with it, to learn the skills of how to do it, to hire the equipment. It's been a fairly long journey in terms to get it to the point where we're fully comfortable and we're happy with the outcome, but we wouldn't have it any other way. Mm. I think it's been one of the best things we've ever done, not just because it's utilizing the waste, but because it's getting us brand recognition. It's helping share our story. And it's creating connection with our customers, whereas as a fruit producer in the commodity market, we have no connection. So even if we think we're producing a good product, we don't actually know. We don't get the direct feedback whether people are enjoying it. All we really see is the financial statements telling us we got paid for it. And you hope that it's a good return, but a lot of that just tends to come to whether there's a good supply or not. It has nothing to do with quality.
That must feel personally really rewarding.
It does. Look, farming is really rewarding in itself, but this, I guess, is very much rewarding in that, like, when we're serving a drink to a customer or giving them a tasting, we're doing that with this heightened anticipation. Mm-hmm. I have no idea if someone's going to like it or not. I just sort of hope that they do.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying I don't like the criticism, but when people do say, oh, that's not for me, I've got to go, all right, why isn't it for you? What can I learn from them? I think as much as your supporters are really important, your critics are just as important too. Because if you're not listening to your critics and you're only listening to your supporters, you just get surrounded by this echo chamber and you don't actually know if you're actually doing any good. So I figure that that kind of works for me and works for us.
You know what? It works both ways though, Mitchell, because I've witnessed customers here today at the Grounded Festival taste your product and they're hearing your story. They're seeing the farmers and your family background and story around your brand. So they're also taking something from the experience, which is so important around that storytelling piece. You make it sound really simple. And I know there's a lot of investment, yep, which must have been scary and risky. So in terms of equipment and facilities, like, what does it look like on your place?
Well, my dad likes to joke that you could perform surgery in our facility. And we did that intentionally. So I'll just give you a little bit of background. So we have what we call our soda shed. It's basically a brewery. We've got pressurized chilling tanks. We've got a brew kit. We've got a canning line, pasteurizer, boiler, all these relatively technical pieces of equipment and fairly expensive as well. What we did initially, we didn't make the upfront investment. We went to a brewery and hired their equipment. And while in doing so, we developed relationships, networks, and learned from them. And what that meant was we could tap into the craft beer industry. And if you don't know already, the craft beer industry in Australia and WA has been booming and there's been a huge amount of investment in it. What we could then do is go tap into the network and go, oh, well, has anyone got some spare tanks? Anyone got a spare canning machine? And we realized the more people we asked, the more equipment that was already out there that existed that wasn't being used. It was surplus to their requirements. So we thought, well, why don't, instead of buying new and spending $1 million on a facility, which we can't afford and will never justify, let's just go to them, buy their secondhand gear and do it for basically, I don't know, a quarter of the price, get it serviced, get it maintained, build it back up to brand new, and then suddenly it's viable. Again, I am probably making it sound a little bit easy, but that, I think, if you're going to be a farmer and jump into this space, I always tell people, start off really, really small, do it bare bones in your kitchen, because that's where we started. We started with a Thermomix on the counter and the oven. That was it.
Yeah.
And when we made enough money, when we sold enough, oh, we'll buy a bigger piece of equipment. When we made enough money off that, oh, we'll buy another bit of piece of equipment. It's just been a real natural process. And what that means is, and it's a really lovely feeling for me now, because when I'm in the facility and I'm canning all this stuff, I often like say to Jen, I said, Jen, how lucky are we in that we know where we started from and we know all the trials and tribulations, how hard it was, to now see it working so perfectly and so beautifully that we get to enjoy it. We haven't just, you know, gone to the bank and borrowed $1 million and got the best gear off the shelf. We've had to work for it. And I think it means you actually do appreciate it a lot more and you don't waste that opportunity as well. And that's what we're always trying to do, is to try to make sure that we're doing everything with intent.
And I feel like what this southwest region of WA does really well in that horticulture space is that collaboration between growers and businesses. So surely you're processing more than just passion fruit through your facility. Tell me about how you've connected other producers to this system.
I guess because there is such a diverse range of especially fruits in our region, early on we had quite a lot of farmers come to us and say, oh, I've got a surplus. Can you do something with it?
Like what, for example?
So we did kiwi fruit, citrus, blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, a lot of strawberries actually, and plums. Oh, and cherries. Cherries are a big one in Majma. So we had people literally giving us fruit and say, please, 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 like do something with it. But we found it was actually a bit of a trap because it's not that hard to process it, but it's very hard to try and sell it. And that's where it comes back to the intent is like, well, we're passion fruit growers, so we want to process the fruit that we have. If we're processing everyone else's fruit, we sort of lose track of our passion fruit. So we had to sort of say to the farmers, look, we're happy to process it, but we want you to make the products. So we'll make it an easier format for you to use, and we'll even bottle it, we'll can it, we'll do whatever you want for it. But at the end of the day, it's your fruit and you're still responsible for it. And if you want to go through what we've had to go through, we'll support you. And I think that's been a really good approach, because then those farmers who are producing their waste, they're starting to value the work that goes into producing it or value adding it. Because it's not as simple as here's some free fruit. You can now make $1 million off it, because my work doesn't start until I get the free fruit, essentially. So it, to me, it's not free. To me, it's work. We had to learn those lessons, and the farmers as well, they had to sort of learn those lessons. But now what it means is we get people who are really eager to work with us, and they go, right, the wine industry is in a downturn right now. I want you to make me a sparkling grape juice. And we just in this last year, we had two wine producers come to us, never made a non-alcoholic in their life, and they now they want to get into the non-alcoholic space. If we weren't doing what we're doing, I don't think they would be doing those two products. So that collaboration helps us by, one, utilising our surplus equipment so we can contract to them, and then two, I'm doing all the work to then give them a product at the end of the day, and all they really see is their grapes going in, and then they see a can coming out, fully boxed up, fully labelled. So for them, it's great. They can go to their markets, they can try and sell it, and they already know what their cost of production is, and they know what their retailer wants to make. So that's where their work starts back up again. So it's really good collaboration, I think, there, in that where we were once just farmers, we're now also becoming service providers.
Manufacturers, really?
Well, manufacturers, yeah. And like manufacturing in Australia has definitely been going backwards and hasn't been going forward at all. But it's nice to see that people still want things to be manufactured locally.
And I love it that you telling your own story about your own product. So in your case, passion fruit. I mean, really, it's competition, that sparkling grape juice, right? But I come to your place. I've just bought a yuzu soda. Before today, I didn't know what a yuzu was. What is a yuzu?
I hope I don't butcher this, but it's a Japanese lemon, essentially.
Yeah.
People sort of say it tastes like a bit like a grapefruit crossed with mandarin, but it's got a whole range of uses outside of its juice. You know, the skin can be dehydrated and used in drinks. It's really good for cooking, aromatics, these sorts of things. But up until a year ago, I didn't even know what a yuzu was.
Yeah.
But a local farmer came to us and said, oh, we've been growing this yuzu, but our customers want it in juice form. They don't want to do the juicing themselves. Can you juice it? I said, yeah, well, absolutely. We'll juice it. First time juicing it and tasting it, I thought, oh my God, this is the best flavor I've had from a citrus. Like, so powerful and so different to what we're used to. And that point of difference, that uniqueness of telling the story as well. Like, people do go, what the heck is a yuzu? And you get to share the story. Whereas a passion fruit, everyone knows what passion fruit is. They know what they want it to taste like. So there's a different sort of connection there with your customer. But it's great that a farmer came to us, asked us to juice it, and now we've become a market for them. You know, we've created a product from their juice. And I think that's where it all sort of ties in nicely.
And you've value-added your business between you and Jen, which is wonderful. It's a great success story. But you've also value-added other farmers who are in your shoes and also the community, of course, with that ripple effect. So I think that whole storytelling element of your business is really interesting. So thank you for your time, Mitch, in sharing with me.
Well, that was a great conversation with Mitchell. And one of the reasons I wanted to run this episode early in the year is because it's the kind of story that reminds you what is possible when people stop treating waste as an unavoidable cost and start seeing it as a problem that can be engineered into an opportunity. The other thing I took from it was how important it is to listen, not just to supporters, but to critics and customers too, because that feedback loop is what turns a good idea into something that actually works. And back here in New Zealand, at home, to those dealing with the flooding situation, stay safe, look after each other, and do not be afraid to ask for help, because rural resilience is real, but it is not meant to be carried alone. Thanks for listening to the Weekly Hopwire. We will catch you again next week.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.